All right, I think we are ready to start. All right, so let's jump right in. We were in the middle of Perek, well, in the middle of the speech of the final speech of the Amal, the builder or the toiler, and we looked at, I'm going to share my screen. Again, if you can keep your videos on, that will be helpful because it will give me, I see all of you on my screen as well. We were in the midst of this discussion of the Amal. We saw him pick up the pieces at in the middle of Perek Hey, Yeshua Achola. It's a quick review of last week. Yeshua Achola, he is grievously disturbed by what he has heard, and the concern that he has is this notion of wealth and building and creating for the sake of, and that's the question mark, right? For the sake of what? If one builds and creates and amasses and achieves, and then what happens is he loses it all. Then he has a child, Walid Ben, and he has nothing to bequeath to the child. He has nothing to hand over to the next generation. And so as he leaves the womb and as he leaves this world, with nothing to show for all of the effort, this is also a terrible, vexing evil, gamzora achola kolumat, that he should leave exactly as he came, empty. And what profit does he have? What benefit does he have for all the effort toiling to the wind, shi'amol laruach? So essentially what the Amal has done here, and this is where we looked at this in detail last week, is he's presented the challenge. He himself has kind of looked at this from the perspective both of the Yireh Elokim, who said to him, just do and God will help with the rest. And he says, what's the purpose of all of that? But more importantly, he says he himself started from the position of he doesn't want to have to amass all of this wealth and achievement and accomplishment for somebody else. He was doing it for himself, and he's matured. He went through Perek Daled. He went through the whole experience of understanding what it means to work for a klal, for a tzibur, for a community, and the melech. And even though that was a failed effort in terms of understanding the solving the problem of justice and evil in the world, but nonetheless, it's given him a sense of purpose to build and to toil and to amass and to create for somebody else. But what happens if he builds and amasses and toils for somebody else and he doesn't have anything to show for it at the end of the day because it all gets lost? It all just goes poof, stock market crashes, and that's the end of it. So therefore, he sort of realizes that the whole exercise of building and amassing and doing and creating for somebody else is inherently flawed because eventually it could all go down, it could all go up in smoke or down the drain, however you want to use the analogy, whether the analogy of wind or water, up to you. In the end, he comes back to his conclusion, which is Pasuk Yud Zayin. If the only conclusion left, therefore, is, he says, and this is remarkably similar to the words of the Nehenet, so one could even argue that this is actually the Nehenetan speaking and kind of interjecting into the middle. I'm less convinced of that. But nonetheless, essentially, he takes the position of the Nehenetan and he says, okay, well, if I can't build for somebody else because either I don't want to, or as he's matured now, he wants to, but it might all go up in smoke and he might lose it all. So then the only real solution is to benefit from it while you still have it. So at least you can toil and benefit from it. And that solves all his problems. It solves his problems of what is he amassing, for? Is it for somebody else? No? Okay, so have it for himself. If he doesn't have what to inherit, what to bequeath, because he loses it all, so at least in the meantime, he'll have it and he will benefit from it. And that's where part one of his speech ends. And he even quotes the Amal, he even quotes the Nehenetan in a very dramatic way. Osher and Chasim Mishlitol Lechom Mimenu, every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and has given him the power to eat and to consume and to benefit from it, Lechom Mimenu, Velaset Et Choko, Velismach Ba'amalo, Somatat Elokimi. And we saw in the source page, I shared with you the comparison. And again, the source page I posted in the chat, if anybody wants to just repost that quickly for the benefit of those who just joined. The comparison between this quote of the Amal and the same quote of the Ne'anatan back in chapter 3. Behold, I see that what is good for a person is to eat and drink and to enjoy the benefits of all of his toil, that he toils under the sun. For that is a gift of God, Zumatat Elokimi. It's exactly the words of the Ne'anatan. That's why I said that I can easily argue that this is actually the Ne'anatan interjecting. Either way, we come to the same conclusion because he's going to reject this momentarily. But that's the position that he takes at this point, and it seems to be a temporary solution to all of his problems. However, then we move to chapter 6, and we're not finished with the Amal. And that's where we pick up today. Yesh ra'a asher ra'iti tachat ha-shamash. Everybody, give me a thumbs up if you can see my screen, hear me, everything's clear, everything's good. All right. Yesh ra'a asher ra'iti tachat ha-shamash, v'rabahi al adam. There is a terrible evil that I still see under the sun. Remember what the solution was. The solution was, to eat and to drink, and to see benefit. Let's look at it in Pasuk Yichet. Gam kol adam shenatanu elokim osher unechasim mishlitol lechom imenu. God has given man riches and wealth and given him the power to eat or to benefit from it, to consume it, to be the recipient of that good. Right? That's a gift from God. Great. But, Isha Sheyiten Elokim, Osher Unechasim B'Chavod, if a person is given wealth and riches and honor, V'Nenu Chasil Nafshom Mikol HaSheyitaveh, and lacks nothing for all that his soul desires, right? That's the goal here now. That sounds like the goal of the hedonist of the Ne'anatan, but now it's the goal of the Amal. Well, if that's true, what happens if tomorrow the stock market crashes? What happens if tomorrow the value of my property turns into zero? And I go upside down on my mortgage and now I'm broke. What happens if all of that I have amassed gets sinks in the bottom of the sea? It's all sitting on a ship. And God does not enable one to eat or benefit or consume it. Some stranger will steal it from me. All my life I toil and I build and I create and I amass, and now I've assumed that it's all not for somebody else, but it's for me so I can benefit from it and do something with it. And what happens if comes along somebody and takes it from me? And God doesn't enable me to eat it. So if I'm able to consume it, if I'm able to benefit from it, we said that's matat elokimi, that's a gift from God. But what if God takes it away from me? What happens then? And just to understand, chapter 6, one of the problems with this online text is that you're not seeing you're seeing chapter by chapter. So let me take you to the source page for a second and go back to the first page, and you can see the sequence of it. Remember, this is one speech, chapter 5 and chapter 6. So he starts with, Kol Adam Asher Natanu Elokim Osher Unechasim Mishlitol Lechom Mimenu, every person whom God has given him wealth and riches to and power over it to consume it, to benefit from it. That's a gift from God. But what if Isha Sheyiten Lo Elokim Osher Unechasim V'Chavod, God has given man wealth and riches and honor, and then V'Lo Yashliten Lo Elokim Lechom Mimenu, when he doesn't enable the person to eat from it? So I've taken that which is a gift from God, and now I've transformed the circumstance into a hevel v'choliba. This is terrible. This is worse than it was before. You can see these two psukim side by side, which is the last chart that I gave you on the source page, right? This is in chapter 6, and this is chapter 5, the same speech, right? There's literally line by line. The only difference is he's added this negative, right? God has taken it away from him. Well, now it's nothing. And if that happens, it's, again, it's an if, okay? But let's just work with that if for a second. If that happens, where does he end up? If that happens, he ends up more or less where he started, right? He's now lost everything. So now he ends up exactly as he started, with nothing, except that he's gone through the whole journey of building and amassing and doing and toiling and in the effort, and he's ended up with nothing for it. That's very frustrating. Yomid ish me'ah, a person could father 100 children, v'shanim rabot yivya, and live for many years. Perhaps yushin yimei shana, he lives many, many long years. V'nafsho lo tisba min atovah, but his soul is not filled with the good and the satiated achievements of all of his lifetime. He ends up with nothing. Gam kvura lo hayta lo. Remember, in biblical terms, if you don't have land, you don't have a burial place. And so if you lose property, if you lose your land, if you lose your ancestral land, they didn't have communal burial plots. They had ancestral burial plots. Gam kvura lo hayta lo. Then he has nothing. He doesn't even have a burial plot. Like Achav, who was cursed that he would die or Yezebel, that he would die without a burial. Says Kohelet Amarti. Now here he gets very negative, and so I apologize for the intensity of the imagery, but it's in the text. Amarti Tov Mimenu Anafel. I said of such a person that the stillborn is better than he, because he behevel ba uvachoshech elech. He comes in darkness. He comes in vanity, in darkness, and he goes in darkness. And his name is covered in darkness. And he never sees the sun, and he never has to see the light of the sun. There is more rest for the stillborn than for the one who dies without the burial after an entire lifetime of toil that ends up with nothing. This is probably one of the most pessimistic moments in the book, where he describes a circumstance where he says it's better not to be born, which is more or less what he said at the beginning of chapter 4, and we're going to come back to that moment where he talked about the tear of the oppressed that has nobody to comfort it. It's better not to be born into such a world. But here he talks about the journey, and remember we said last week about the notion that the womb is an imagery of a grave, and so we go from the grave to the grave, right? That cycle of the earth, that's in the language of Chazal, the rechem is called a kever. The notion here, the analogy here, is very harsh, that he comes in darkness and goes in darkness. B'choshech elech b'choshech shmo yuchuseh. Never has to see the sun, never is born. Nachat l'zeh mizeh. This one has rest rather than the other. The notion that because of the toil and because of the anguish and because of the suffering that he has gone through in all of a life of effort and toil and amal that has ended up with nothing, better not to have been born, is essentially an argument that we are familiar with. We've heard it before. Anybody who's ever studied the book of Job should recognize those verses, because that's exactly how Eov starts. Eov starts with a frustration of, after he's lost everything, he curses the day he was born. And he curses the day he was born, and he uses this analogy of darkness as a kind of a parallel. Just wanted to show it to you briefly, kind of get a sense of it. This is the beginning of Iyo Perek Gimel, the first two chapters of Iyo are the introduction of the storyline, if you will. And then he's frustrated, he's quiet, he accepts everything with silence, and at the end of chapter two, he's taunted by his wife and his family, and he says, and they say to him, after 7 days of silence, don't you have anything to say for yourself? Finally, his grief was so great that so he opened up his mouth and he cursed the day he was born. Yovad yom ivaled bo, but the day in which I was born perish. And the night in which it was said a man was conceived, let that night be perish. And he goes on and he talks about Ayomahu Yidushel, that let that day be darkness, let not God inquire of it al Yidushel, let darkness and the shadow of death claim it. He constantly refers to this idea of choshech, this imagery of darkness, which is Kohelet's whole message, right? That he, the stillborn, never sees the sun, and he never has to go through that experience. Halaylo yikachayu ofel, that night, let darkness seize upon it. If you go down a little bit further in the chapter, he more or less says the same thing over and over again. He says in Pasuk Lam Yud Aleph, Lama lo mirechem amut, why didn't I die in the womb? It's exactly what Kohelet has just said. Mi beten yetzati ve'kva, why didn't I perish at birth? Madur kidmuni bekayim, why did the knees receive me? Why was I born? Just to have to suffer so. Kietasha chafti vashkot yeshanti az yenuach li. But now that I should have lain still and been quiet, I should have slept, I would have been at rest. Yenu az yenuach li. Again, nachat lazeh. Mizeh, it's the same language. Better rest to the stillborn than to the one who dies at the end of his life with nothing to show for the effort. Or Pasuk Tet Zayin. Let's go down to Pasuk Chaf. Again, language and imagery from Kohelet. Lama yiten la'amel or. Why should light be given to one that is amel, one who is in misery, and life to the one who is bitter? Iyov's starting position is exactly the same as Kohelet, the amel, namely, the stillborn, or the one who is never born, curses the day he was born. It's better off because he doesn't have to go through the experience of all of that frustration. I see a hand raised. Brian, you had a question?
Yeah, it was a while ago, and it was related to the circumstances that the Amal lost everything. Does that situation include a situation where he hasn't lost everything, but he, the subject of the wealth, isn't able to enjoy it for health reasons or for some other reason?
Any circumstance in which he's unable to benefit or somebody else benefits from it instead of him, which makes it even more frustrating. We're gonna come back to the question of the extrapolation to this, to the existential state of the human being. There's a point in which he jumps, but I'll come back to that in a second. But in the notion of darkness as a symbol of that futile cycle, be born in darkness, to end his life in darkness, and throughout his life, the stillborn didn't have to even see the sun. He's better off than the one who has to see the sun and then die in darkness. That's all a repetition of something which we saw at the very beginning of the book. Kohelet started with this futile cycle of nature, and one of the symbols of that futile cycle of nature was the sun. The sun, the earth, the wind, and water. We're going to come back to those at the end of the parak. So here he uses that imagery, but he uses it to great effect. He comes back and he says, this is how we started the book. We started with the description of the futile effort of nature, and we are, and the sun rises, the sun sets, and what do you get for all of that light? And that's exactly what he says. In my life, if I look at life as that journey of the sun rising and setting, I'm born from the darkness of the womb, I end up in the darkness of the grave, and what have I achieved in the context of that span of lifetime? Now, the notion that he's actually ended up, Kohelet himself has at this moment ended up exactly where Kohelet started. And the Amal has ended his own description here in exactly the same place with which he started. Because the first speech of the Amal we saw back in chapter 4, going to come back to that now for a second, Shavti, where he was responding to the Nenatan who said, we are not in control of this world, it's all God, we just go along for the ride, we just enjoy God's gifts in the world, and at the end there's justice and there's injustice and this evil and cruelty, that's God's problem, not mine. Remember that position of the Nanatan? Back in chapter 3. To which Kohelet, the Amal, said, Shavti ani veret kol ha'ashukim, I see all of the oppressed, and I see the tear of the oppressed, with none to comfort them, in etimata ha'ashukim ve'en lem menachem. And their oppressors have all the power. Miad oshkeim koach. V'shaber ani tametim shekvar metu. I therefore praise to the dead who are already dead and the living who are still alive, because they don't have to see all of that suffering. And better than both, the one alive and the one who has gone through it all and has died, v'tov mishnehem et asher eden lo haya, is the one who has never not yet been born. Asher lo ra'at maaseh ra'a shenasa tachat ha'shamesh, who's never have to see the evil under the sun. And therefore, since that's not a solution, that's not a realistic solution, not to be born, Kohelet goes on this journey to find his answer from the perspective of the Amal. So at the end of 3 chapters, we now come to the end of chapter 6. And what is his conclusion after all of that? His conclusion is, Tov mimenu anafo. The preference is to the stillborn, doesn't have to go through all of that. What? So that's exactly where he started. But he started in chapter 7 from the perspective of better not to be born than to have to go through all of, watch all of this from a perspective of an idealistic world of the Amal who embraces the world and who wants to fix the problems of the world and who wants to, and he can't tolerate the suffering of the tear of the oppressed. And therefore he says, if there's nothing I can do about it, I'd rather not be born. But there is something I can do about it, so let's go through the journey. Then he comes into chapter 6, and in a moment of despair, he's gone from the height of idealism to the depths of despair. He says, there's nothing, if everything I amass and I do and I accomplish is for myself, is for the benefit of it, is to enjoy it, and I can't because somebody else takes it away from me, then I'm back to where I started. And if not only in philosophy, I'm back to where I started, but in my own journey, the Amal's own personal journey has brought him back to where he started. So we're going to see that a lot in Kohelet, with the metaphor of the opening description of the futile cycle of nature is not just a metaphor for the arguments that each one makes, but it's an argument, but it's also a metaphor for the journey that each one of these personalities, with the exception of the Elohim, goes through as they themselves, in their own arguments, find themselves back where they started. So not only are they addressing the futility of the cycle of life, but they themselves take that same journey and end up back where they started. That's part of the literary power of this approach to Kohelet. Okay. Having said that, however, there is a huge gaping hole in the logic of the Amal's argument. So just to put in perspective, he starts with the sense of, okay, if I can't amass it all and leave it to my son because at the end of my lifetime I might lose it, I might as well enjoy it now while I have it. That's where he started in chapter 5. And then he says, well, what if it gets taken away from me even before I have a chance to enjoy it? What if I build and create, and now I want to consume it, and it's gone because somebody else blew it up or took it away from me or did whatever they wanted to do with it. So now I'm stuck. Right? The stock market crashed. I lost everything before I even had a chance to eat my steak. So now what do I do? So now life is worthless. But there's a gaping hole in that argument, which is,
So why bother?
so that's what Coelho's saying, why bother? But what's there's a challenge in that, there's a hole in that argument, which is you came up with a solution. The solution is go through the journey and the effort and benefit from it and build and create and then eat it, consume it, and benefit from it yourself. Enjoy life. Enjoy it. Okay, fine. I'm happy to enjoy life. And then you say, but what happens if the stock market crashes? And you won't be able to enjoy life. So if that happens, so you better not to be born. Okay. But what if the stock market doesn't crash? What if I can retire comfortably? What if I'm planned everything really well and I've got everything in order and it's all good? In other words, Coelho has taken the extreme negative experience of a human being, and he's extrapolated from that to the condition of the human experience. Is everybody in that boat? Do we all feel every day of our lives that life is futile because I might lose it all if the stock market crashes like it did in 1933? Where's the jump from the individual to the state, to the existential state of the human being? Father, the problem is he's created a scenario. What if God doesn't give him the power to eat? What if foreigners have to, he can steal everything he owns? What if? Then better not to be born, but most of us aren't in that position. And so because it might happen one in a thousand, on what basis does Coelho extrapolate to the overarching condition of the human being? And here we come to perhaps the most profound statement in this perspective of the Amal, which takes us back into the text, Pasuk Vav. Ve'ilu chaya elef shanim pa'amayim. A person could live 1,000 years twice over. V'tovah lo ra'ah, and yet never see good or enjoy good. Elo makom echad ol kol alech, everything goes to one place. And I draw your attention to Pasuk Zayin. Kol amal adam lefiu. All of man's labors for his mouth, and yet the soul, the appetite is never satiated. If you remember back to our first description of chapter one, when we talked about the analogy of the four states of nature, and we talked about the various cycles, and one of them was the cycle of water. All the water goes into the sea and the sea is never filled. I used this verse at that time to explain that that was a metaphor for the Amal. Why? Because he builds and he builds and he builds and he creates and he wants to eat and he wants to consume and he wants to build and he wants to benefit, or actually it was the Nehenet at the time, but he wants to enjoy what he has. And the problem is he can't. Why can't he? So at the beginning, earlier in the chapter, he can't because God might take it away from him. And suddenly we realize that he can't for a much more profound reason. Because the more we have, the more we want. The more one eats and consumes and benefits and enjoys, the more one feels that there's no end to that, right? I can eat a meal and 6 hours later be hungry again. And sometimes an hour later be hungry again. Depends on what I ate, right? I can, the nefesh lo timaleh, if the goal of the soul is to be satiated, that's if wealth is there to amass, to achieve, I will never be able to say I've reached my goal, because every time I reach, I move the marker, I move the goal post. The more I have, the more I want. And now suddenly I'm in a cycle that has no end. That's the existential condition of the human being. That's not a what-if scenario. That's a fact. Chazal were keenly aware of this perspective, and they countered it by a very famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, Ezu Ashir HaSamech B'chalko, who is wealthy? One who is satisfied, who is happy with their lot, with their portion, with that which God gives them. That's the perspective of the Yirei Elokim. Whatever God gives us, that we have to be happy with what we have. But this is the Amal speaking. And if the Amal is speaking, his whole goal is to be goal-oriented. If I don't fulfill the goal, I haven't achieved my purpose. Well, if now my goal is to satiate, is to fulfill, I want to amass and fulfill and enjoy to the maximum that I can. Now suddenly I'm in an endless cycle that has no, I'm in a bottomless pit. Kol amal adam lefiyu. All of man's labor to be consumed, but the soul is never satiated. The appetite is never filled. A nefesh lo timaleh. And at that point, Kohelet throws up his hands and says, okay, now we're into a cycle that has no end. Now we're back to where we started in the text. And you'll see from the rest of the verses from Pasuk Chet to Pasuk Yud Bet sound just like the beginning of the text of the book. Ma yoter l'chacham min aksil, what advantage is the wise over the fool? Ma l'ani yoder l'anoch neged achayim, what does the poor man have to walk? That knows how to walk before the living. Tov mamei naim alach nafesh, better the sight of the eyes and the wandering of desire. Gamze hevel lurut ruach, mashayak fani kvashmo, what was, will be, always has a name, nadashu adam. V'lo yuchal adinim shetakip mimenu, man cannot contend with one who is mightier than he. Ki yeshrim harbeim, marbim, mayotel adam. There are many words that are vanity. What proof does man have? This is all, it almost sounds rambling, right? Various free pieces of the story that we've had. Had it in the beginning of the story, and we'll have it at the end of the story. It's just rambling. Ki mi yodea matov l'adam machayim mispar yemei chayev lo. What? Who knows? What good is there for man to do in one's lifetime? Brief lifetime, like a shadow? Shemi yagid l'adam hayeh acharav, because man can't know what the future will be under the sun. So what is man's good? What is man's accomplish? What is man to do in this world? The question with which Kohelet began, that was exactly the text with which Kohelet started in chapter 2. Right? Let's go back to Kohelet chapter 2. Right? Kohelet chapter 2. Eze tov livnei ha'adam asher yasu tachat hashamayim mispar yemei chayehem. What is it for man to do? What good should man do under the sun, that he should toil in this world? What is his purpose? What is the good? How does he end chapter 6? Who knows what the good is? The Amal certainly doesn't know. He's thrown up his hands. He's failed. He's written himself out of the story. And the irony is that that's exactly what happens to him. He has written himself out of the script. From chapter 7 until the end of the book, we will not find the Amal speaking anymore. He is replaced by the Chacham. And so I sort of told you at the beginning of the story that there were four personalities in the book debating and talking to each other. Not exactly accurate. There are really only ever three involved in the debate. The Amal becomes the Chacham, and then the Ne'anatan and the Yirei Elokim continue the conversation. And that's what happens to the Amal. He's changed his position to essentially become the Ne'anatan, to enjoy with the world, but he's realized that is not an accomplishment that has any achievable goal. And the difference between them is that the Ne'anatan is there to enjoy the ride. The Amal has to achieve something. But if my achievement is in the category of what I build in this world, then that is unachievable. Remember, that's the Yirei Elokim who said to him, "It's the journey. It's not the goal." Right? God is as a partnership with God. The Amal says no. And that's where he brought us to the end of chapter 6. So I'm going to stop here for a minute, because what I want to do in the next piece of our story is to take a big jump back, because we've gone to a lot of different variables and a lot of different ideas and a lot of different conversations and texts. And what I've prepared for you is a kind of a summary of where we're at in the text, because we're at the midpoint. We've seen the Amal twice, we've seen the Nehanatan once, we've seen the Yirei Elokim once, we've now seen all the major personalities of the first half of the book. We've reached the midpoint. Chapter 7 starts the next unit. And so it's a really good opportunity for us to kind of take a step back and look and do a quick review of everything we've done up until this point. Before I do that, I'm going to stop and say, and ask if there are any questions on what I've just done. All right, then here's the next step of the story. I just posted in the chat the next source page. Next source page, which you're welcome to print out, or you can just follow along on the screen. For the benefit of everybody, this is I kind of was going to share this at the very end of the course, but Kohelet gets so complicated in terms of the various themes and ideas that this is a really good moment to take a step back and look at the whole picture. So for the next 20 minutes, I'm going to try to do a bird's eye review of what we've done till this point. Okay, everybody with me? Here we go. You ready for the journey? Hold on to your seats. Okay. More or less, I'm going to read or review what's here, because I've already written it all up, but I want you to have it, and we'll kind of do a quick look at it. So first, to remind ourselves that we're talking about Qohelet as a conversation, a dialogue between different views, not just a book that is contradicting each other, but there are four distinct voices in the text. And as we've just said, three of them are always talking to each other. These four voices are reflected in the introduction, which describes the challenge of the book, the endless cycle of nature, earth, river, sun, and wind. And that, I'm not going to go through the text. The text you have talked about, and I'm just going to go do the summary. Those four cycles that involve generation after generation, right? One generation comes, the other generation goes, Dor Alech, V'Dor Ba, the Aretz Olam Amadet, and the earth endures forever. The river, the water, Kol HaNechalim Olchim El HaYam, the water that goes into the sea. The wind, Alech HaSafon, Sovev Sovev Alech HaRuach, the wind is constantly turning around the world, and the sun, which rises and sets and doesn't get anything for the journey. They represent the four states of nature, and metaphorically, the four personalities of the book. There's not a one-to-one correlation, but more or less, that's what we had identified. And the basic problem is the futile, endless cycle of what is the purpose of the world? Two profound questions Qohelet deals with throughout the text. One is the nature of good and evil. What is good under the sun? What is bad under the sun? And the other is the purpose of life versus death. Right? Chaim and Mavet. So those are the two major themes. We actually connected those two themes to the tree of life and the tree of knowledge, the Eitz HaChaim and the Eitz HaDaat. Ladat Tov V'ra, knowing good and evil, Chaim and Mavet. And that brings us back to the beginning of the story of Gan Eden. We'll come back to that in the story of the Beit HaMikdash, which we'll see in a moment. That introduces us into the second introduction of the text, which is from chapter 1 to the end of chapter 2, in which we see each of the three main personalities of Qohelet: the Amal, who wants to leave his mark on the world, the Chacham, the philosopher who wants to understand the world, the Nehanatan, who wants to enjoy the world, and then, of course, the Yirei Elokim, who wants to utilize the world to serve God. So we'll talk about him separately. Each of them parallels a particular aspect of Shlomo's life. And we saw this, and I showed you the references, the builder in all the amassed building constructs of Shlomo HaMelech's life. The man of pleasure, certainly at the end of his life, that's what does him in. That's what undermines his success. And certainly the story of his wisdom is well known. Shlomo himself, as the author of this text, and the personalities involved in each of these domains. So he begins his life, and this connects us back to the tree of knowledge and the tree of life. Solomon begins his story by building the temple. And he has this moment where God comes to him in a vision, and he says to him, I'll give whatever you want. And he asks for an understanding heart to discern between good and evil. Lev shamea havin ben tov l'ra. Which is very reminiscent of the request of Adam HaRishon to eat of the tree of knowledge, l'dat tov l'ra. He's given that, he's granted that, which defines the three domains of worldliness, osher, chachma, and kavod, wisdom, honor, and wealth, which parallels the three personalities of Kohelet. But he's told that without the key to long life, which is the key of obedience to God, this is worthless. That's the Eitz HaChaim. And essentially, Adam, he's put into a position where Kohelet, where Shlomo HaMelech kind of repeats the mistake of Adam HaRishon by grasping for the tree of knowledge instead of the tree of life. That more or less becomes the theme around which Kohelet will end up and conclude. But that is the basic structure of the introduction of the text. That brings us to our first main speech, which is the Hedonist, or the Ne'anatan, who starts in chapter 2, the end of chapter 2, and mainly in chapter 3. He starts with this perspective, which is, again, what defines the Ne'anatan is that he's not in control. His job is to be the recipient of the world of nature. He's to be the recipient of the world that God has created. He has no control. That's how he sees the world. It's the exact opposite of the Amal. And so the world of nature is seen in that regard as perfect, created by God. Man's function is to enjoy the pleasures that God has created for him. We saw that famous song of the times, L'kol zman ve'et l'chol chefetz, because of its conclusion, ma yitron al sed, to change God's equation for the world is futile. Your goal is to enjoy it. God made a perfect world. Kol ha'sayefe bito. And our world, our job is to enjoy the world. The problem he faced was that the world that God created might be beautiful. That's in Gan Eden. But the world that man created, which is outside of Gan Eden, is a world in which Cain kills Hevel and the world goes down from there. Society is deeply flawed. And in a world in which evil and injustice is allowed to flourish, what can we do? Well, again, the Ne'anatan, to be the Ne'anatan, has to stay true to that argument, which is that we are not in control. And so he throws accountability for that back onto the shoulders of God. It's a tzaddik v'yata rasha yishpot elokim ki et l'chol chefetz v'al kol ma'aseh sham. God will judge the wicked. Our job is to receive the world. Well, if man is just to live in this world and live on instinct and passion and benefit from the world that God created, then he's really like an animal. He has no contribution to make, and so that's his concluding statement, Umatar ha'adam min ha'behima ayin. Man is likened to the animals, cannot affect change in the world, but only live an instinct. In walks the Amal in chapter 4, and says, in such a world where there is oppression, where there is tear of the oppressed, and the Ne'anatan's argument that you can just, there's nothing you can do about it. One cannot enjoy a world and leave injustice for God to handle, because then life itself loses all meaning. And in such a world, it'd be better not to be born, as we just finished describing. V'tov mishnehem et asher eden lo haya. Better than the one who is born and dies, better than that is the one who is never born in the first place. He never has to see the affliction. So that's not a solution. So he rejects the notion that man has no impact on the world, and he takes the position that man is totally in control of the world. There is nothing other than man's efforts to build and to create in this world. On the other hand, he's identified two profound problems with that. Number one, who am I toiling for? I could build and build and build and create, but it's all for me. What do I do after I die? I throw death into the equation. What's left? I have nothing, nobody to, right? I have to be able to give it to somebody. I have to be able to continue that effort. That's one problem. The second problem is that the motivation behind, the societal motivation behind creating and building and doing, typically is the guy next to me is doing more than me. I have to work harder or do something to be more successful. Jealousy. Kinat ish mere'ehu, he calls it. So what good can come from something which is inherently negative? So he comes up with a solution which is very similar to classic terminology of socialism, which is, don't do it for me, do it for the next guy, do it for the neighbor, do it for the person living next to me, do it for others. I'll do it for you, you'll do it for me, together we build a society, and society continues forever. Society, dor lech v'dor ba, society has continuity to it. Solves the problem of the heir, and it solves the problem of the motivation. The common goal is for everyone in that society to build together. What do I do with the injustice that exists in the world? Says Kohelet, in this kind of worldview, right? If I take the extrapolation from two are better than one, tovim shnayim min ha'achad, three are better than two, achut of mishulash, lo b'mirah yinatek, and extrapolate to, right? The Yama likes to extrapolate, as we've seen, to an entire society. Well, who leads that society? The one who leads that society is the king. And so the society marches to a single message as the leader of that society can take responsibility for the solution of all the problems of injustice and tears in the world. Great. So Kohelet has just gone from the world of the individual, what is my purpose in the world, to, okay, I'm going to take all my problems in the world, we're going to throw them onto the shoulders of the king, and let's see what he can do with it. Well, Shlomo was more in place and more potential to address all those challenges than any other king in human history, and he was a failure. And so his own experience proved the failure of this approach. Tov yelev misken v'chacham imelech azaken uksil. These are all quotes from each one of these speeches. The poor child who emerged from jail to take over and lead the path of justice, which is a reference to Yeravam ben Nevat. For all of his noise and promise of a better future, he fared no better than the old king who could no longer take care of himself. Mimelech zaken uksila shelo yada lizeher. And so his failure is in the realm of not philosophy, but in practical terms. His own experience led him to fail. Which brought us finally to the most important voice in the text, namely the Yirei Elokim. And the end of chapter 4, the last verse of chapter 4, and the first half of chapter 5, is the response of the Yirei Elokim. And the message of the Yirei Elokim, I'm going to do this in the order in which it appears rather than the way we initially looked at it. The message of the Yirei Elokim is twofold. Number one, to the Nanatan, who complained bitterly that there's a lot of evil and injustice in the world and God will have to take care of it, says the Yirei Elokim. V'libcha lo'al yomehel lo'tzi davar lifnei Elokim. Don't complain so much. Be careful. Careful what you complain about. To the Amal, his response was, don't promise so much. You think you can do better? Right? We talked about the neder. Better not to make a neder at all than to promise and not be able to fulfill. There's an arrogance in the Amal's perspective in chapter 4, which is off the charts. I'm in control. I'm in charge. I can do it all. Up to even that of the king, says the Yirei Elokim. That's... You're out on a limb here, and that limb is about to crash. The response to the Amal, who claimed the king was solely responsible for justice in the world, Shlomo Yeravam, says the Yirei Elokim, don't promise so much. Who says you're capable? Who gave you the power to control the world? And that led him at the end to the sense of our message here, or our purpose is not to be exempt from working or doing or toiling like the Nanatan claimed. Man is not exempt from working, but rather trying to develop and advance the world as much as he can. Not in the context of Amal, where it has to have a value, it has to have success, or it's useless. That's the perspective of the Amal. So the Ne'anatan is wrong, the Amal is wrong, but rather from the perspective of the word Avodah. Av Melech L'Sadeh Ne'evad, Mutukashna Ta'oved. The Yirei Elokim doesn't use the word Amal, he uses the word Oved. Do work, service, that has intrinsic value. The effort is valuable because it gives us meaning in our own lives, but there's a partnership with God. We'll talk about that partnership in a moment. And that's his response to everybody's response to the Ne'anatan. You have to work, you have to achieve, you can't throw responsibility onto the shoulders of God. And his message to the Amal, right? Whether you see results or you don't see results, that's not your department. You have to do the maximum. The process of trying is, that's our responsibility. And that brings us to the world of the temple. Remember, we're talking about a king. And the world of the temple, and he starts with that notion, Shmor raglecha kasher telecha bet elokim, guard yourself as you enter into the palace of the king, enter into the temple. The world essentially is controlled through a hierarchy of man and God's partnership. And that hierarchy is symbolized by the two palaces in Yerushalayim, the earthly palace where the king sat, and the heavenly palace where the palace of God, who is the king of kings. And Yerushalayim was built in such a way that you, as you came up the hill from Ir David, you saw the Mikdash, the palace of Shlomo, and above it you saw the Mikdash of the Beit HaMikdash, and therefore you had that sense of the hierarchy, which is referenced or reflected in that Gavoa Me'al Gavoa Shomer, that sense that there is somebody higher than high, in that partnership together between man and God, between the king and the king of kings. If you see affliction and oppression in this world, don't give up, like the Ne'anatan, and don't throw out the towel like and think it's all on you, like the Amal, but rather recognize that there's a partnership. And together, you do your effort and God will do his. The central focus of the temple, therefore, is, right, in the temple, there are essentially two elements. There are sacrifices, which is a reflection of man's voice, and there is nevuah, or Torah, which is in the Holy of Holies, which is God's voice. Don't get the priorities mixed up. The central focus of the avodah, of the mikdash, is not the sacrifices. It's not to express man's voice. It's to hear God's voice. So he begins by this very famous phrase, Karov lishmo, amitetak silim zavach. Better come close to listen rather than to bring sacrifices of fools. And there's a partnership, but in that partnership, you need to be listening to God more than you need to be expressing critique and control of the world around us. And that was the world of the Nen. That was the world of the Yirei Elokim. That's how he ended up in this picture of Yerushalayim. Gavoh me'al gavoh shomer. Comes along the Amal in the final chapter of this unit, which we've just finished. And he says, he comes back to this notion of amelut. The Amal notion of amelut does not tolerate the perspective of the Yirei Elokim. If I can't achieve, if I can't do, if I can't be responsible in some way, he almost denies the role of God, then other than to be the antagonist to my efforts, then it's all meaningless. And so the Amal throws in one last effort, which is to build and to build and to build in order to have something to bequeath to society or to the next generation of the world around me. It's on my shoulders. We're back to the Amal. But what happens if God, not only is it not a partnership with God, but God is frustrating my efforts? And everything I have is lost. And I no longer have it. So then I have a child that I have nothing to bequeath it to. So at that point we've seen also the maturing process of the Amal. Because in chapter 2, he was so egocentric that he couldn't even imagine working for the benefit of anybody else, for this, the one who will come after me, he called it. In chapter four, he was concerned that they wouldn't have an heir. He wouldn't have somebody. He wants to build for others, but for whom? And now his concern is he wants to build for others, and he has society or next generation to build for. But what happens if there's nothing of my efforts left after a lifetime of toil? There's nothing to show for it. And if all the attempts to toil for the future fail to provide meaning, then the only benefit left is to benefit now before I die, to live for the moment, which is exactly the position of the Nanatan, while the Amal has come to it from the opposite direction. And then he comes to his famous conclusion, which is what happens if you can't even do that? You can't even enjoy the fruits of your labor. Then you're really better off not being born in the first place. And that, we said, is an extrapolation of the human condition. Kol amal adam lefiu v'kama nefesh lo timaleh. If the amal is so focused on achieving the goal of this world, which is to build and to perfect and to enjoy and to benefit and to achieving it to the maximum, if that's what defines the amal, and if I can't, I'll build another building, or I'll do another investment, or I'll have another meal. If I can't accomplish it now, I'll accomplish it tomorrow, and then tomorrow after that, and it keeps moving from me, then that's an elusive goal that I'll never achieve. And so his conclusion is that it's better not to be born, but better not to be born is not a solution. And so he ends up coming full circle into a throw up his hands and say, Mi yodea? Who knows? Ma tov l'adam? What is man's good in this world? I have no idea, says the Amal. Which is exactly where he started in chapter 2, saying, what is man's goal in this world? And here he says, the answer is, I don't know. And so the Amal, for all intents and purposes, has come full circle and written himself out of the story of Kohel. That, in a 16-minute summary, is the first six chapters of Kohelet and the first three main voices of the text. With that, I will stop and open it up to questions.
Very sad conclusion.
Well, we're not at the conclusion of the text yet. No.
But to this chapter.
Correct. No, the amount of all of the personalities of Kohelet, the one who is most depressed is the Amal.
Yeah.
Because he is constantly frustrated. And he sees the world through the glasses of the only thing that exists is what I can accomplish. And what he can accomplish is never the whole task. So the Amal is really one of the most depressing and desperate personalities in the text. The Nenatan at least has the benefit of enjoying what he has. And the Chacham, we'll see, we haven't seen the Chacham yet. But at the end of the day, and I want to reiterate this because this is so important, a Torah perspective, the total picture of the perspective of Tanakh, the correct view of Kohelet is not the Amal, and it's not the Chacham, and it's not the Nenatan. It's the Yirei Elokim, because the Yirei Elokim will, at the end of the text, incorporate elements of all four. The Yirei Elokim will eventually integrate all four stories of Kohelet. So he's very important for us, but we haven't gotten there yet. So that's an important piece.
Modern man is a little bit different than this, because we as Jews don't necessarily attach ourselves to society as a whole, but to our particular group within society, assuming we're outside of Israel. So that's one element. The other element is economics has a theorem that people forget very quickly. So in other words, intellectual property, you give them patents, and the theory is that after 20 years, everybody would be better off if you eliminate them. People won't invent things. They forget very quickly. 10 years afterwards, they will invent things again. And 20 years after that, you eliminate it. The same thing with, let's say, real estate, where I live in Toronto. Every 20 years, you hear, this time it's different. Prices of real estate will never go down. And people who are, you know, we have short memories that way. So we constantly renew our approach to these things.
So my response to you is open the opening verses of Kohelet, which are, Ein kol chadash tachat ha-shamash. It's nothing new. Right? That's exactly what he says.
Except that we forget it.
What was will be. People forget its name, right? Who knows what will be in the future? What will be in the future already was. It already has been named. It just has a new name. That's exactly what Kohelet says. But the Yirei Elokim is a much very different perspective, because he's able to look at the long picture. And so you're right. In the world of the Amal, the Ne'eneh, and the Chacham, they're going to constantly come back to this Ein Kol Chadash Tachat HaShamash, right? There's nothing new. Everything was. It's a constant, right? We just change the names to protect the innocents, as the expression goes. So that's an interesting observation, okay?
Thank you.
Any other questions? My pleasure. You have the source page and you have the summary sheets. The summary sheets are part of a much longer unit of all of the summary of the whole text, but I've shared with you the piece of it up until what we've done right now. And now next week we start chapter 7, which is a whole new personality of the Chacham, and we'll go from there through the second half of the book. He gets much more dramatic in the second half because he deals with the issue of good and evil, not life and he deals with the issue of life and death in the context of theodicy and why do the righteous suffer and all of those big questions. Those he addresses in the second half of the book. So we will start chapter 7 next week. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your time. And we will see you, Bezrat Hashem, next week.